welcome to Pedder Unplugged. This is the podcast about Tasmania's wild, mystical, and controversial Lake Pedder that was flooded in 1972. Yep, 50 years ago this year, this national icon was flooded to create a hydro storage lake. And ever since the flooding, the campaign has continued to see it restored to its natural state. I'm Tabitha Badger, and today I'm joined by Carol and Richard Donaghy. Carol and Richard are extraordinary bushwalkers. These guys have so much worldly experience. They've really seen it all. But something about Pedder, something about Tasmania, has just captured their imagination. They live in the remote northwest of the state, so reception's a little bit patchy. In this episode, Carol and Richard share their stories of bushwalking in Tasmania, their experiences with legends like Tenzin Norgay and Alagus Chahanas, and how much Lake Pedder has impacted their lives. So if you enjoy a good Tasmanian bushwalking story, this episode is for you. So please, enjoy this episode of Pedder Unplugged with Carol and Richard Donaghy.
I'm Richard Donaghy, and my memories of Lake Pedder go back more than 60 years. I first became aware of Lake Pedder in 1961 when I started a degree in agricultural science at Sydney University. I joined the Sydney University Bushwalkers, and I saw the images of Lake Pedder that older members showed at the slide evenings. And so I decided I had to go down to Tasmania and see it for myself. So I first came to Tasmania in December 62, and then I started bushwalking in January of that year. So that's 60 years ago. Together with my fellow bushwalkers, we flew into Lake Pedder, and it was a beautiful fine day. The view of the lake coming up was just stunning. It was just breathtakingly beautiful. And we landed on the beach and just sort of didn't really want to leave, but we went off to climb Mount Anne. We came back to Pedder, and then we walked to Medina over the Sentinel Range. So that was my first experience of Lake Pedder, and it was just truly amazing. So my next encounter was with Pedder was later that year in December 1963. When the Sydney University bushwalkers came down to Tasmania again to traverse the Western Arthurs, and very few people had done that. So the first person we wanted to talk to was Alagus Chahanas, and that was the first time I met him. And so we met Melba and Alagus in their West Hobart home that Alagus built, and they were both very generous people. We were truly astounded by the feats of Alagus, and he showed us all his slides and his magnificent black and white photographs of the Western Arthurs. And he was obviously supremely fit because he would say, you know, I'd race up the moraine here to Mount Hayes, pitch my tent, and then I'd just sit there and wait for days for the perfect photograph to get the right light and the right shadows and the right clouds. But he had no ambition of doing a traverse. He did most of the Western Arthurs, and he had a beautiful set of slides. After that trip, I guess I went back to university, but in 1967, I was working in New Guinea, and so I wanted to go to New Zealand to do some snow and ice climbing, and that's when I met Carolyn, and so we were kindred souls, and we walked with the Sydney University bushwalkers and alpine climbed in the Alps, but later there was just the two of us, and so I came down to Tassie in October 69, we got married, and then in December of that year, we just decided to go back to Lake Pedder and walk into the Western Arthurs.
And
you should have pulled me up to it.
But when I first saw Pedder.
Yeah.
And I was a first year university student, 1964, at Tasmania University. And I joined the mountaineering club. Now, I was already a really keen mountaineer because I'd been part of the Hobart Walking as a 14-year-old. So I basically joined them as a 14-year-old. So as a 17-year-old university, I was a really keen bushwalker, and therefore every weekend that's what I did. So I was invited to join. They were all leaving students. They're all third-year university students, or third and fourth year, you know, so well, sort of people who'd actually bushwalked for their whole university time, and they invited me to come along on a Mount Anne at Easter, and Mount Anne sort of Easter was 4 days and Mount Anne was a pretty remote peak in the, you know, at that time. But what we'd heard is that the HEC had actually started putting in a road and therefore it would mean that we could do and climb Mount Anne in 4 days. And rather than starting off at Mandina, Port Davey track, which was, you know, a fairly decent walk in from Mandina if you, you know. But Easter, we decided, right, this can be done, and that's what I did. And basically, and I won't go into the details of the whole walk, but sitting, when we actually got to sitting on the top of Mount Anne on that, on the second day, we walked in to Condominium Creek on the first day, and the second day we climbed Mount Anne from Condominium Creek and sat on the top of Mount Anne, and we had this amazing jewel in front of us. Like Black Pettit was the jewel of the Southwest, and it was that, yeah, was just amazing. And we sat there and didn't want to leave the top from seeing that view of Mount Anne, but seeing that view of Pettit, which was the jewel, you know, of the Southwest. It was just a fantastic experience. And so that will always live with me, that Easter trip as a first-year university student into Mount Anne. So that was 1964. And so basically I spent a lot of my other years then at university bushwalking, but never went back into to Mount Anne, because what had happened at that time, in 64, Lake Pettit was actually part of the national park. It was declared national park. So it had a status, so we didn't ever think that that would not be there. But it, after that, of course, in the, I think it was, you know, 67, and then by 69, the government reversed everything and then decided that the whole thing was going to be flooded. And so it was pretty tumultuous times. And I decided that I really did want to actually walk on the beach at Pettit. I needed to do that if I could. And it was at the end of the school term. That's what we do. We packed up. We packed our packs, put in 10 days' worth of food, and decided to go in there.
Before we go back to Pettit, Carolyn, you can talk about Alagus.
It was a bit of a time. Of course, I joined the canoe club at the uni, and I actually went canoeing with the Alagus. And so I guess the whole Alagus to harness Pettit and Tasmania is sort of very much part of me. You know, somebody I had huge admiration for what he could do, and I suppose also it was pretty tumultuous times. And I used to go up to the old hut, and there was a Lagos's black and white photos around the walls, which were just amazing. So I guess, that influence of him and his photographic work and his amazing physical, you know, pursuits that he achieved basically by himself was an inspiration to me.
Thanks, Carol. We decided to go back to the Western Arts. Carol hadn't been there before. But in the spirit of the Lagos, we weren't going to do the traverse. I was just going to show Carol some of the very special places. So we walked up the moraine, up to Mount Hayes, lingered there a bit, walked on to Square Lake, a little bit beyond where you get the magnificent views of Lake Oberon. And what Alagus used to do, we'd sort of race up one moraine and then, you know, get his pictures and then race down another moraine. So from Square Lake, we just took off down a moraine down to the plains again. And then we walked into Pettit. And it was absolutely amazing and really joyful going back there. And who did we see on the beach? The whole Alagus family, Alagus, Melba, and two of their children. And Alagus was there getting as many photographs as he could, because at that stage we all knew that it was going to be flooded.
Yeah. I guess we left for Canada. You know, we left for Canada the next year. Yeah. And I guess when we came back to Tasmania, coming back to, you know, you just wanted to talk about the Franklin campaign, just how we weren't able to go out into the bush, and because that was your first year teaching, but how that was a really something that we followed all the time. We watched it and we were influenced by everybody that campaigned hard for that. And I was just thinking of that the morning of the High Court decision.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Carol. Yes, I was teaching, and I think it was about 11 o'clock when I just heard the decision that, the decision by the High Court went in favour 4-3 to save the Franklin River. And so I was euphoric. So I was supposed to teach a certain subject, but instead I just went into the classroom and for one whole hour I talked about wilderness preservation, the Franklin and everything else. And the students just sat there mesmerised. Yeah. But later some of them came up to me and said that, I work in that area now in restoration and, you know, so that was really good. So that was a real highlight.
What impact do you think losing PETA had on the successful campaign to save the Franklin?
Oh, it had everything to do with the Franklin campaign. I mean, for one thing, like the Wilderness Society, they were so much more informed, they were more media savvy. You know, we didn't have a Lagos, but we had Peter Dombrowski with these photos of the slips and Big Island Bend. All those were just sort of so pivotal. It was just so much more sophisticated. And, of course, we had the right Prime Minister at the right time who was willing to step forward and say, we'll save the Franklin.
Yeah, and we also had that energy, the conservation movement had energy to really to save it. Like PETA had been lost and we were so devastated by that, you know, and therefore it was like, you know, we're going to fight, you know, this needs to be won. You know, I think we felt really strongly and that the energy was definitely came about from the loss of PETA, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and the spirit was like, never give up.
That spirit is very strong still today when 50 years later we still have the campaign to see PETA restored.
Yes.
Carol, you said before we started recording that you've got a poster of Lake PETA on the wall.
Yes, I do. And it has been on our wall for the last 35 years. Yeah, 35 years. So I walk past it every day. So it's the iconic one, you know, the iconic with the St John quote at the bottom that one day how we can undo what so tragically has been done, you know, that to undo.
Yeah, so, something like we can undo what has foolishly been done.
Yeah, so we're very much behind the restoration and I think it's an incredibly exciting year. And I do feel in my lifetime it won't happen, but I just really like to think that it will happen.
Well, I'm hoping that Carol says it may not happen, but I would like to see it start to happen very soon, like in this decade, in the decade of ecosystem reconstruction. So that's what you're.
So before you went to Canada, what was the community sentiment around PETA? Were people broadly aware of the issue? Would you say majority of people within the community were outraged about the prospect of flooding PETA, or were people largely in support of it because of the magnitude of the hydro and the number of people that it employed locally?
Yeah, well, Carol can talk on behalf of Tasmania, but I grew up in Sydney, and when we came back from Canada, we stayed a few months in Sydney while I was waiting where to go, and all my old bushwalking friends were absolutely fans of the Lagos, so he'd already died in his tragic accident, and it was like, you know, if only we had more Laguses. But the spirit was really strong amongst all our, you know, Sydney friends.
Yeah, I have to say, the community didn't know, you know, because it wasn't publicised. It was, you know, as bushwalkers, you see, and as keen, really committed bushwalkers, we knew, but there weren't many of us at all. And so to get the message out to the ordinary, you know, population, they were completely unaware, really. They were completely unaware because the hydro had enormous power and prestige and support because of jobs and all those sort of things. And I just really feel there wasn't any knowledge of there wasn't any awareness of the amazing natural environment that we have. I mean, Lagos, you know, he was just one person and he could influence people like us, but there were not very many other people, you know. He influenced people, but it's still a small number in the end when you think about everybody. Things operated differently through the media, you know. You just...
Did either of you ever get to experience a Lagos' slideshow?
He had quite a few, you know, and I did go to one in the tunnel when I was still at school, yes. I just remember there being an awful lot of people there. It didn't have the effect for me as it did for some people, because I was fortunate as a teenager that I spent so much time walking. You know, I actually had, I'd actually spent even an Easter with Tenzing Norgay, because Tenzing, you know, actually came to Tasmania at our education, I think, and they organised a camp for young people, and I was a 14-year-old at that time, and so I'd actually, you know, spent time, you know, climbing mountains with him, and so I'd actually been, so therefore the natural environment, you know, the mountains, and would just so much part of me then. I actually realised the importance of them and how magnificent and how important they were. And Peter Dombrowski was also in my class too. I mean, he was a very quiet person in the class, but I guess as a student I was particularly, I was very, very fortunate to have these experiences, and so therefore a slideshow for me didn't have the impact as it did.
What was it like walking with Tenzing?
Oh, Tenzing. Yeah, well, what a beautiful man. You see, he, humble, you know, and wonderful, wonderful to actually, yeah, to walk with someone. This was actually at Mount Field. Yeah, we climbed all the mountains, you know, Mount Field West and Mount Field East, and a wonderful experience, because at night he would, you know, he would just talk. He would talk. We'd have the little talks of how you live your life. I have a photo of him. I took a black and white photo of him standing outside Peterson's Hut. And just the fact that he came to Tasmania just to spend time in our little peaks with young people was...
What an experience for a few Tasmanians. That's extraordinary. Have both of you together or individually been to the present Petter impoundment?
Yeah, we have, but it took many years. It was 20 odd years for Richard. I think I did that, but Richard didn't want to come on that trip with me, and he said, "No, I'm not going in there."
Yeah, thanks, Beryl. Yeah, so we were training to go to the Himalayas in Nepal. Our last walk was the premier day walk in Tasmania, Mount Annadale. So I said, "Okay, we'll climb Mount Ann." So that was in 1996. So that was the first time I went back and actually saw Craig Petter. And I wrote in the logbook that, I didn't really want to come here to see Craig Petter, but, you know, I've seen it now, but it's taken a very long time. Now's the time we've got to start restoring and reclaim the true Lake Petter.
And in your conservation experience, you spoke before on the Franklin about the right Prime Minister at the right time and the momentum flowing on from the loss of Lake Petter. Is there a time now when we are in this climate and biodiversity crisis, there's an uprising of young people fighting for the environment, that you can see that the circumstances are perhaps aligning, that there is now a window where restoring Lake Petter is a real possibility for Tasmania?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. Despite what's going on around the world, I mean, we really have to seize the moment. This is the decade where we've got to think big as you're doing, and, yeah, I think things can happen. And I think it will be a beacon for the rest of the world to show what can be done. You know, throughout history, especially in North America, you know, dams have been decommissioned and restored, so... you've got the evidence there from your research. It's just a political will now. and get the people behind you. And I'm optimistic it can be done.
And what about you, Carol? Do you share?
Oh, yeah, look, I hope so too. You know, I do. It could be wonderful because in an age where now restoration is actually talked about, you know, wonderful thing to show how it can be done so well, you know, so we have that opportunity. I mean, the stage is set in a sense.
And I'd like to think we're heading that way too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an optimistic prospect in what otherwise seems like such a bleak future for the natural world and by association humanity. For both of you, and it's probably really difficult to pick just one thing, but what were the really, you know, defining features of PETA? Is there anything in particular that really made it that jewel of the Southwest?
Yeah, it's more, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's more than just a jewel. I mean, it has that, I know when I first went there, that sort of, it's that hypnotic sort of mesmerising feeling about you. It's just so peaceful and tranquil. You know, the sand beaches and the lake and, you know, the Flinker Range and the Mariah Creek and all that together. It's just, there's no other experience like it, you know. And I just hope that other people can have that same experience in the future.
It's hard to pick out, though, something about PETA that is the whole place was incredibly special. Like when you sit, you know, on the top of Mount Everest and you see it and, you see that sand, the white sand and it's just like a picture that you couldn't imagine more beautiful, you know, and I suppose, you know, the mountain ranges on either side and the way the book was framed by the mountains. Like, so it's like somebody to draw a beautiful picture, and how could they ever get it so beautiful? You know, it's like, how could it be so beautiful? How can, and that's why I think, but when you actually, when you were there on the sand, it was again like it was there. Is this real? Like you had a feeling of that this sand was so unlike anything else in the Southwest. You know, so that to me, the jewel of the Southwest was there was nothing else like it.
Episode 7 of PETA Unplugged with Carol and Richard Donahue. As always, if you'd like to learn more about Lake PETA and to keep up with the restoration efforts, visit lakepeta.org. Or if you'd like to share your stories with us, send us an email, lakepeta.org@gmail.com. I'm Tabitha Badger and thanks for listening.